Hello, everyone, and welcome. I am Siri Vaith, the Executive Director of the Cystic Fibrosis Research Institute, CFRI, and it is my pleasure and my honor to welcome you to our 35th national, though truly international, Cystic Fibrosis Education Conference, Focus on the Future. Our speaker tonight is Dr. Stephanie Strathy, a renowned infectious disease epidemiologist. Dr. Strathy is Associate Dean of Medicine, Associate Dean of Global Health Sciences and the Harold Simon Distinguished Professor of Medicine at the University of California, San Diego, where she now co-directs the Center for Innovative Phage Applications and Therapeutics, or IPATH. In 2016, Dr. Strathy and colleagues were credited with saving her husband's life from a deadly superbug infection using bacteriophages, viruses that attack bacteria. Dr. Strathy and her husband, Dr. Tom Patterson, who you will hear from later this evening, then co-authored the incredible book, The Perfect Predator, A Scientist's Race to Save Her Husband from a Deadly Superbug. And if you have not read this book, I encourage you, get the book and read it. It is an incredible story. For her efforts to revitalize phage therapy in the West, Dr. Strathy was named one of Time Magazine's most influential people in healthcare in 2018. Please give a virtual warm welcome to Dr. Stephanie Strathy, who will present Finding the Perfect Predator. I'm turning it over to you, Dr. Strathy.
Thank you so much, Siri, and welcome everybody. In some places of the world, it's the evening, others it's the morning, and I'm just thrilled to have the opportunity to talk to you today. Now, you might be wondering, what does phage therapy and superbugs have to do with cystic fibrosis? Well, as Siri has mentioned, as the new treatments have become available for cystic fibrosis, many people living with the disease are living longer. And as a result of that, their superbugs are living with them. And the more exposure that folks get to antibiotics, that unfortunately can breed superbugs. And superbugs are bacteria that are resistant to multiple antibiotics. So unfortunately, I know about this firsthand. My family was directly impacted by a superbug, and I stumbled across a 100-year-old forgotten cure that saved my husband's life. So I'm going to talk about that. I have a lot of help doing it, and you're going to hear about that as well. And I have a couple disclosures. First, my husband and I actually hold stock in a phage company now. I never thought I'd be directing a phage therapy center, but there you have it. I'm also an unpaid advisor to Felix Biosciences, another phage company. All the patient photos that I'm going to show today are used with permission. And where I am in San Diego today, my land attribution to the Kumeyaay people, where I sit on unceded land. So my family's story began in 2015. My husband and I are both professors at UC San Diego, and we travel around the world to exotic places, usually for work, but sometimes we tag on a couple of personal days. And my husband had always wanted to see the Valley of the Kings. And so we went to Egypt over Thanksgiving in 2015, and we were having a great time. Really a vacation of a lifetime until the very end. Now, you'll see these from these photos that my husband is a big guy, 6'5". At the time, he was about 300 pounds, so he was definitely overweight. But to all appearances, he was in perfect health. There he is, crawling backwards down inside the Red Pyramid outside of Cairo. But a couple of days later, he felt violently ill after we had this wonderful seafood meal on top of our cruise ship. And I just thought he had food poisoning. You know, he ate more than me. There was a lot of seafood that was in that dinner, and I wasn't thinking much of it. But the next day, when he wasn't able to keep anything down, not even water, I called back home to San Diego, where we happened to know a friend of ours who was then the chief of infectious diseases at UC San Diego, Dr. Chip Schooley. And I asked him for advice, and he said, wow, Tom really needs some fluids and probably some antibiotics, and call a doctor. So I called a doctor to the ship. And when he said, you know, your husband is going into shock, well, so was I. And they rushed him to the nearest clinic. There was no hospital in Luxor where we were based. The doctors did the best that they could with limited resources, and they diagnosed him with pancreatitis, which is an inflammation of the pancreas. And I thought, okay, well, that's fine. You know, now that we know what the problem is, we can treat it, right? Well, wrong. It turns out that that was just a symptom of a much bigger problem. And he started to have complications. Well, luckily we had travel insurance and we got medevaced first to Germany because he was too sick to make it home right away. And in Germany, you can see on the right-hand side of the slide, I'm in full PPE with a gown and gloves and a mask, and Tom is fading in and out of consciousness. I took this selfie for Facebook thinking that they were going to cure him with from whatever problem he had, and we'd be home in no time, right in time for Christmas. But this was just the beginning of what ended up being a 9-month long journey for Tom in the hospital, because it turns out that he had a gallstone that had lodged itself in his common bile duct and caused a giant abscess to form because of the pressure. And unfortunately, that abscess, which was the size of a small football, was a perfect place for a superbug to move into. So the doctors came to me after they'd done an endoscopy to see what was going on. And they took some culture from the fluid, which was this brown putrid fluid. And the doctor said, look, you know, if that fluid had been clear, then that would have meant that this abscess had just been formed, but it's not. It's been there for a while. So unfortunately, you know, there's something growing in this abscess now. A couple of days later, he came back to me with the solution and he said, this is the worst bacteria on the planet. It's called Acinetobacter baumannii. And he wrote it down for me and it just, you know, ringed a little bell because I'm Canadian. Hi to all the Canadians joining us from my homeland. And I had taken my undergraduate degree in microbiology at the University of Toronto, and we used to plate this organism on Petri dishes. And all we needed was just a lab coat and gloves. And you know, I was, you know, probably 19 at the time. And I remember it being a really wimpy organism, like, you know, so how could this become one of the world's worst superbugs on the planet? Well, it turns out that Tom became a poster child for this new post-antibiotic era that we are entering. And by 2050, it's estimated that superbugs will kill about 10 million people per year. That's one person every 3 seconds. And the situation is getting worse and not better. So you may wonder, well, how did we get into this? And it's our overuse and misuse of antibiotics. We can get into this in the discussion period. But it was a surprise to me because I had to bone up on some of this literature that about 70% of antibiotics in the US and in Canada and many other countries are actually used in agriculture, in livestock and crops, for example, to make animals fatter because of our addiction to meat. So unfortunately, that's the biggest source of antibiotic resistance. But if you don't take your antibiotics the way you're supposed to, or if you take them when you're not supposed to, say you're trying to take them for a viral infection like COVID, that's not appropriate. So all of those things breed resistance because the bacteria that survive become mutant bacteria that can outlive those antibiotics. So, you know, you might be thinking, well, why don't we just make more antibiotics, right? Well, that was the solution for most of the 20th century. There were new classes of antibiotics that were coming along, but because of resistance, we see that pharmaceutical companies are getting out of the antibiotic business. Since 1990, there hasn't been a single new class of antibiotics. They're all just rips on the old kind. So what this means is there's no new antibiotics in the pipeline, and you know, simple infections can actually become deadly. That used to be treatable and are not treatable anymore. So back to our story, that was the situation for Tom. When the doctors did what's called an antibiogram, they told me that right off the top, his superbug was resistant to 15 different antibiotics. And over time, it acquired resistance to even more. And he was medevaced then back to San Diego after they stabilized him in Germany. And this photo was taken after the doctors told me that he wasn't going to make it. And it was incredible shock to me because I just couldn't imagine that, you know, modern medicine had run out of tools to fight what I used to call a wimpy organism. So this photo, you know, you can see that Tom is on a ventilator because his lungs were failing. He was on three different pressors to keep his heart pumping. And the doctors asked me if I wanted to put him on dialysis because his kidneys were beginning to fail. And he was in a coma at this point, and I didn't know what to do. And I asked him if he wanted to live. It was one of the hardest conversations I've ever had. I asked him to squeeze my hand if he wanted to live and that I would leave no stone unturned. And I waited. I didn't even know if he could hear me. And he did squeeze my hand. He squeezed it really hard. So now I was really excited thinking, okay, he wants to live. And then I thought, well, crap, like, what am I going to do? I'm not a medical doctor. You know, I have a PhD, but that's not doing me any good here. And some of the top infectious disease physicians in the world were treating him and they had run out of solutions. So I did what anybody else would do. I went home and I hit the internet. And there is a wonderful search engine that the National Library of Medicine, which is part of the NIH, has developed. It's called PubMed, P-U-B-M-E-D. It's open to the public. You can put any search words in there, keywords like, you know, Acinetobacter baumannii, multi-drug resistance, alternative treatments. And for me, up popped this paper. And buried in it was something called phage therapy, short for bacteriophage therapy. And I knew what phages were because, again, I'd taken, you know, this microbiology degree back in the 1980s, and I knew a little bit about phages. And it turns out that phages had been discovered over 100 years ago. In fact, the first activity of phages, which are viruses that have naturally evolved to attack bacteria, was observed by a British bacteriologist, Ernest Hankin, on the shores of the Ganges and Jemuna River. And the research that he did was repeated by others, another Brit, Dr. Frederick Tort, a Pole, Dr. Bronislav Fagan, and some Russian researchers as well. But none of them could figure out what exactly was killing the bacteria until Georgi Ulyava, until Felix de Harel, sorry, a French-Canadian self-taught microbiologist deduced that whatever was able to pass through a Pasteur filter, which filtered out bacteria and was still able to kill the bacteria, must be a parasite of bacteria. And he named this bacteriophage, derived from the Greek meaning bacteria eater. Well, he teamed up with this guy, Georgi Ulyava, who is a Georgian from the Republic of Georgia, not Atlanta, Georgia. And they started the first dedicated phage therapy center in the world in what is now Tbilisi, Georgia. And this is right around the time that World War II was brewing. And phage therapy got the reputation of being Soviet medicine. And not only that, penicillin was being developed and it brought to the field to help in the war effort. And as a result of penicillin, which had broad spectrum activity against bacteria, the West decided to forget all about phage therapy, and it only continued to be used in parts of the former Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe. And so the Ulyava Center, for example, and the phage therapy unit in Wrocław, Poland have been operating for decades. But in the West, all of North America and Western Europe, phage therapy had been forgotten. So this was a shock to me because this is now considered experimental treatment in the US. And I was really wanting to figure out, could we, you know, use this to try to cure Tom? So first, a little bit more about phages. So this is a electron micrograph. So this is a bacterium stained in orange and it's blown up 100,000 times. And you can see that these little alien spiders that are stained in green, they are the phages. They look kind of crazy. And they're attaching to a receptor on the bacterial cell and they drill into it if it's a match. And their genetic material, usually DNA, enters the bacterial cell, turns it into a phage manufacturing plant. And so the bacterium isn't making any more bacteria. It's actually a zombie. It's making lots of these little phages. And when given the kill signal, these baby phages burst out and kill the bacterial cell in what's called lysis. And these bacteriophages, the baby ones, can go on to attack new bacteria as long as that they're a match. And those that they don't find are a match, then the phages are just eliminated from the body by the spleen and the liver and the system that's attached to that. So it's a very specific kind of reaction. They don't kill any bacteria that they're not a match to. And that's a big contrast to antibiotics that often have a broad kind of reaction where they kill the friendly bacteria in our microbiome. And we know now that that's not a good thing. So it turns out phages are about 100 times smaller than bacteria, so you can't see them with the naked eye or even a light microscope. And they're the oldest and most populous organism on the planet. Like, there's an estimated 10 million, trillion, or a nonillion, that's 10 to the power of 31 phages on the planet. And they come in all shapes and sizes. At the bottom of this slide, you can see a couple of them. They look a little bit like they're from Game of Thrones or something like that. And so they have been used to treat people as early as 1919. So I got excited about the idea of using phage therapy to cure Tom. And when Dr. Schooley at UC San Diego gave me the go ahead, he said, well, try to see if you can find some phages that are a match for Tom's bacterial isolate. I wrote total strangers. And lo and behold, Dr. Rai Young from Texas A&M University, hello, Texas, they said that they would turn their lab into a command center and try to find phage to attack Tom's bacteria. And the woman in the bottom left who's wearing the necklace is Dr. Adriana Carolina Hernandez. She now has her PhD. She was a student back then, and she slept in the laboratory for a couple weeks to find phages to match Tom's. Now, the weird thing about this story is that where do you find phage? Well, you find them wherever there's a lot of bacteria. And so the best place to find them is like in sewage and in barnyard waste and things like that. So she actually, went through all of these different samples. And also Dr. Young reached out to researchers around the globe to see if they already had phage that were identified and characterized that could maybe match Tom's bacterial isolate. And they offered to help researchers who were total strangers from Belgium, Switzerland, India, other places. And it was really miraculous. And when Dr. Hernandez and her colleagues found these phages that were a match for Tom, it was only a couple weeks of time. Then Dr. Schooley called the FDA to get permission because, again, this is considered experimental treatment. And the FDA put him in touch with the U.S. Navy because they were doing phage research as well. And so pictured on the right is Lieutenant Commander Theron Hamilton, who said, well, send me his bacterial isolate. I'll see if we have a match. Well, why do we need more when we found several phages already from Texas? Well, it's because the bacteria can become resistant to phages, just like that they can become resistant to antibiotics. So ideally, you want different types of phages that are going to attack different receptors of the bacteria, so it has a harder time to mutate. Now, the Navy folks actually sourced their phages from the bilges of ships, and they found four that were a match. So now we had two phage cocktails with the help of the phage whisperer, Dr. Biswas, on the bottom of this slide. And within 3 weeks, we had a phage cocktail ready from the Texans, and a couple of days later from the Navy. And so all of these were approved by the FDA. And the dose that Dr. Schooley determined would be the best to give him was 1 billion phages per dose every 2 hours. Whoa, pretty scary. Nobody knew whether or not that was going to cure him or kill him at the time, because we decided that we would inject these into his PIC line, because at this point he was fully colonized with this organism. It was in his sputum, it was in his blood, it was everywhere. And we were worried that if there was a hidden reservoir of bacteria that the phage couldn't reach, because if we only put them in the tubes in his abdomen, that we would be giving the bacteria a leg up to become a mutant. So here's what Tom looked like the day we began phage therapy. This is now March 15th of 2016. He'd been in the hospital about 4.5 months. You can see that he's lost 100 pounds. He was gaunt. And he was not able to, squeeze my hand anymore, that's for sure. And here's Dr. Schooley on the left and Dr. Randy Taplitz on the right, and they're smiling for the camera because they knew that they were making medical history, whether he lived or died. Tom appears to be the first person in the US with a systemic superbug infection to receive intravenous phage therapy. So first we got the Texas phages and we put those into the catheters in his abdomen because that was the closest source to his infection. And when he lived through that, we thought, okay, the Navy phages are supposed to be more virulent. We're going to get those and inject them into his PICC line. And that happened a couple days later. Then we just waited and we waited and prayed that Tom didn't experience septic shock. But 3 days later, he lifted his head off the pillow and kissed his daughter's hand and made a miraculous recovery. Now, he didn't leave the hospital until August because he had a lot of recovery to do. He was, you know, fully deconditioned, but nevertheless, he made a near full recovery. Our story went viral, but in a good way. It was presented at the 100th anniversary of the discovery of the bacteriophage at the Pasteur Institute about a year after he was cured. And after that, we started to get calls from patients and their families from all over the world. The first was from China. The second was from Malaysia. The next was from India. And it just went on from there. And of course, total strangers had stepped up to the plate to save my husband's life. So I wasn't going to turn them away. So I went to the same people who'd helped my husband, the Texas A&M researchers, the Navy researchers. And by this time, a couple of phage companies had started and we got their help too. And we were able to help some patients and others we couldn't reach in time. Luckily, our chancellor at UC San Diego was so impressed with the success rates that we had that he gave us seed funding to start what became the first dedicated phage therapy center in North America, the Center for Innovative Phage Applications and Therapeutics that Dr. Schooley and I co-founded and co-direct. The day that we opened, Science Magazine, which is one of the top scientific journals in the world, published a commentary saying that this was a game changer. Now, we don't have all wonderful rosy stories to tell because one of the people who contacted me begging for help was Mark Smith and his wife, Diane Shader Smith. I understand that Diane was one of your keynote speakers last year or the year before. And they were desperately trying to save their daughter, Mallory Smith, who had cystic fibrosis and she'd had a double lung transplant. And her new lungs were being attacked by a bacteria that many of you are familiar with, Burkholderia sapacea. Now, Mark had heard about phage therapy long before any of the doctors that were treating Mallory, and he'd actually wanted Mallory to get phage therapy before she got a lung transplant because he wanted to clear the infection so that it wouldn't come back. And at the time, there was no experience with it. And the doctor said that would be out of the question. Unfortunately, by the time she did get her lung transplant, Burkholderia sapacea came back. And I was contacted by a friend of their family who asked me if I could get involved. And of course, I got the same machinery, Dr. Schooley and Dr. Young and the Navy researchers. And I even went to Twitter because it turned out that phages to attack this particular bacteria are pretty tricky to deal with. And not a lot of researchers had familiarity with them. So I went to Twitter and this tweet on the top of this slide was retweeted 432 times. Well, we had a lot of people that wanted to save Mallory and we were certainly one of them. And even though we did find some phages that matched, unfortunately, we didn't get them to her in time. They weren't purified and magnified to a point that it could have done a lot of good. And she was already losing her life. And we lost Mallory. It was really heartbreaking. I just couldn't believe it because she was so full of life. In fact, we've learned an awful lot from Mallory's story. And in fact, she penned her own memoir that her mom and her aunt published after she passed away. It's called Salt on My Soul, An Unfinished Life. I know that many of you have read it. If you haven't, it's just an incredible story. And there's so much courage in it. What we did learn after Mallory passed away, her parents donated a piece of her lung so that we could study what had happened to the phages. even though she only got a micro dose and it wasn't purified to the extent or that we wanted it to be, those phages had already reached her lungs and were multiplying. And that was evidence that phage can actually cross, into organs and start working. So Mallory's parents are convinced that if she'd gotten phage therapy in time, that her life could have been spared. And they have been terrific advocates for phage therapy ever since. Some of the researchers in Israel named a phage after Mallory. So she has quite a legacy. On a lighter note, on the panel after my keynote address, you're going to meet a wonderful warrior and advocate for CF, Ella Balassa. She's actually had phage therapy twice. Colleagues at Yale, who now have their own bona fide phage therapy center, administered phage to her. You can see her inhaling phage through a nebulizer here, and she recently turned 30 years old. She also has a wonderful blog at ellabalassa.com. I urge you to check it out. She's actually made a career out of being a patient advocate, and I think she's a wonderful role model for all of you. The third case I would like to talk about is another friend of mine, Isabel, and she was the first person to receive a genetically modified phage cocktail in the United Kingdom. Isabel's case was really a remarkable one on a number of levels. The bacteria that was attacking her lungs was Mycobacterium abscessus. And this is a cousin to tuberculosis, and that's the biggest bacterial killer in the world. It kills almost 2 million people. And for reasons that we don't understand fully, the only phages that could be found for Isabel's bacterial isolate, there was one lytic phage, that's the phage rage kind that kills the bacterial cell after populating itself inside the cell and then goes on to attack new ones. But most of the phages that could be found were this sleepy kind of phages, as I described them in the book. They integrate into the bacterial cell DNA and hit the snooze button. Well, we don't want to use those for phage therapy because they don't kill the bacterial cell. They can carry harmful genes with them, and they can even collude with the bacterial cell to make it resistant from attack from other phages. So unfortunately, the team that worked on this, they could only find one lytic phage, and they found two temperate or sleepy phages, and they decided to modify those phages genetically by snipping out a gene and forcing those two sleepy phages to become the phage rage kind. Now, the work that was done is really remarkable because it was done by a team at the University of Pittsburgh, led by Graham Hatful and colleagues. And they have a program called C Phages. And it's an undergraduate program that teaches students how to find phages from the environment. The one lytic phage that was the kind that we wanted was called Muddy, M-U-D-D-Y. It was found on a rotting eggplant, or aubergine for you folks in the UK. It was found by a student. All of these student scientists, all of their novel phages, they get to name them. There's over 15,000 of them, and they're in a phage bank at the University of Pittsburgh. So student scientists' phages actually were used to save Isabel's life, which is really tremendous. And this paper that was published on this case in Nature Medicine, another top journal, was a real blockbuster because it was the first time that a genetically modified phage cocktail had ever been used successfully in a human. And also it was the first time that phage therapy had been used on a mycobacterium infection. And that lends hope that maybe someday phage could be used to treat tuberculosis. Unfortunately, Isabel passed away earlier this year. She had an extra 3.5 years of life. 1.5 was wonderful. She learned to drive. She was working. She and I used to Snapchat all the time and play little games. And I miss her terribly. But her legacy is one that is also living on. I also wanted to highlight a case that was not a CF patient. We have used phage therapy to treat all kinds of patients. And colleagues of ours in Belgium were called to help woman who had been a victim of the terrorist bomb blast in Belgium. Remember, at the train station and at the discos. And this woman was only 30 years old, and shrapnel from the bomb embedded in her leg. And although she survived the terrorist attack, unfortunately, that shrapnel led to a superbug infection, Klebsiella pneumonia. And she was losing her leg. She was going to have it amputated. She'd been treated almost 3 years with antibiotics. The infection just kept coming back. And colleagues of ours, led by Jean-Paul Pernet in Belgium, he's one of the phage researchers who offered Tom's case phage in a diplomatic pouch. He's a remarkable guy. He actually trained these phages so that they would be able to attack any of the mutants that would arise from this girl's infection. And so it worked, and she is now walking, and she has made a complete recovery. So this case was publicized just earlier this year. So there's lots of success stories within the CF world and outside of it. In fact, we have published, as have many of our colleagues around the world that we partnered with, a lot of these case reports and case series on this slide are a couple papers highlighted by Dr. Saima Aslam, who will be on the panel. She's actually treated the majority of our CF patients at IPATH. And, you know, but what we really need now are clinical trials. And I'm happy to report that this week, this very week in 2022, the first NIH-funded phage therapy trial to get launched through the Antimicrobial Resistance Leadership Group, which is a network of researchers around the U.S. that have been working on new antimicrobials. This is the first time they have chosen phage to work on. And this trial, which involves IPATH and 19 other centers around the US, has enrolled its first patient. And Dr. Schooley, who treated Tom, is one of the principal investigators. This is a real landmark situation. This was a large trial, $12 million. And the NIH had to be convinced through the case reports that we've seen that it was worth investing in. And so this actually is going to focus on cystic fibrosis patients with Pseudomonas aeruginosa, which is the most common superbug that affects CF patients. And it's focused initially on patients that actually do not require antibiotics so that they can examine the effects of the phage alone. And if you're interested in learning more, you can look into our IPATH website. And we've also got a fact sheet, and there will be a press release within the next few days, I'm told. So you'll be hearing a lot more about this, but we think it's going to be the first of many trials. There's several now around the world that are getting launched. Now, at IPATH, we have had almost 1,500 people contact us asking for phage, but we've only treated a minority of them. And why is that, you might ask? Well, because phage therapy is considered experimental until these clinical trials get done. That means that the majority of people who want to have phage therapy are actually ineligible because they have antibiotic options left, or their condition is not deemed to be life-threatening. We have had our physicians, like Dr. Aslam, who you'll meet shortly, determine that 286 of these cases really should receive phage therapy. And in some cases, the patient passes away before we can even get that going. We have found appropriate phages in 124 of these cases. And again, sometimes the patients die before we can get the phage manufactured and sent to them. So what this really means is that we need to change this model and make it scalable. And one of the ways that we want to do that is to build a phage library, because we shouldn't have to go from bog to bedside every time, right? We should have phages that are already identified and characterized and in a nice phage library like the kind at the University of Pittsburgh. Well, there are phage libraries like this, but they're scattered all over the world. So when somebody contacts us at IPATH or at any of the other phage therapy centers asking for phage, it's like having a million keys and trying to find the lock to match it. So it's really a challenge at this point. So we are doing active fundraising to build a phage library. We have received some funding. Emily's Entourage, for example, is one of the foundations that is focused on cystic fibrosis patients, and they've helped us build a phage library for MRSA. There's CF Foundation has also helped us develop a registry for Burkholderia sepatia that Dr. Aslam is leading. And yet, because there's so many different kinds of superbugs, we need to be able to have like thousands of phages, right? For some of the organisms, we may only need a few, but for some, like the kind that was taking down my husband, Acinetobacter baumannii, we probably need a couple of thousand. So this is one of the things that I'm working on next. And if you're interested in learning more about that, we can talk about it afterwards. But as I'm nearing the end of this presentation, I want you to be aware that the situation with superbugs hasn't gotten any better over the last little while. In fact, it's gotten worse under COVID, because inappropriate antibiotic regimens, like the ones with ivermectin and azithromycin, have been used indiscriminately to treat COVID when it was inappropriate. And when I said in the beginning, if you're using antibiotics when you're not supposed to, it's just going to breed more resistance. As well, the Centers for Disease Control recently reported that there has been a 15% increase in superbug infections in hospitals. And this is largely due to the fact that, resources had to be shifted away from antimicrobials, antibiotic stewardship towards COVID. And there's been antibiotic misuse because of the fear that some of these COVID patients could develop secondary bacterial infections. So we've got a lot of work to do. I'm also getting involved in talking to policymakers to try to make sure that they understand how big this problem is. My husband and I realized that we were really privileged. It might have started out to be the worst experience of our lives, but we realized that he was so fortunate to have this global village that stepped up to the plate to save his life. So we decided to write a book about our story to raise awareness about antimicrobial resistance and also the hidden potential of phage therapy to cure it. And so our book is certainly available, but one of the reasons I give talks like this is to raise awareness and to promote science communication. If you're interested in learning more about iPath, I put the website there as well as my email address. I'm also very active on Twitter. There's a big phage community on Twitter. I also want to thank all of our partners. iPath reaches out to phage therapy programs all over the US and Europe and as far away as Israel and in Canada. And we've got some really wonderful things happening. As I mentioned, Yale now has a phage therapy program. Baylor University does. The Mayo Clinic in Rochester has a phage therapy program specific for prosthetic joint infections. Phage Australia has just started. Phage Canada has recently started. Canada treated its first phage therapy case, a young cystic fibrosis patient, in May. Ireland is just about to have their first case treated. So this field is evolving very rapidly, and it's because of the support that we have and others have received from not just NIH, but from the Mallory Smith Legacy Fund, the Toffler Foundation, Emily's Entourage, the CF Foundation, and many private donors. So I want to make sure that I thank all of them. And I want to let you know that I'm here for you. You have become part of my community too. The CF community is the community that was the first to come to the plate and ask for phage therapy. And so we are doing our very best. So watch this space. And of course, here's the Global Village that saved my husband's life. And I think that they put the word kind in humankind. My view is that if we can do this for one man, we can do it for the planet. So with that, I'll stop and see if you have any questions. Thank you.
Dr. Strathdee, may I call you Stephanie?
Yeah.
That was phenomenal. So incredibly informative. And I have to say, I read the book. I love the book. And for those of you who just heard that, you can see why. I mean, a person who describes, you know, that the bacteria becomes like a zombie, churning out, becoming a little factory. And you know, the analogy of having a million keys that you're sorting through to find one, you know, fit in one lock. I mean, it's these things. I thought I understood phage therapy so much more having read your book. So I thank you for that. And I do love how you connected all the dots because Will Battersby, who is the director of the documentary that was made from Mallory's journal, he will be at our award celebration tomorrow evening. On Sunday, Diane Shader-Smith is actually speaking about advocacy to advance this therapy and other, the push for antimicrobials. And then ending off the conference, Emily is speaking.
Wonderful.
We were going conference Sunday. So just all the dots connected and a total shameless plug, but Dr. Forrest Rower, I saw his photo in that final slide there, who is a CFRI funded researcher in phage. So I just love how the world is small. We do have questions from the audience. We'll get straight to those. First, what's the difference between two different classes of antibiotics? How do folks decide if two different antibiotics are in the same or different class?
Well, it's really about their mechanism of action. And the antibiotics that have been developed over the last decade or so have really been just riffs on the same class. So they just tweak it just a little bit. So you'll hear like, first, second cephalosporin, second generation cephalosporin, third generation cephalosporin, those are all in the same class. What we need are new classes of antibiotics that have different mechanistic actions because the bacteria are smart. They have their CRISPRs. Those are actually part of the bacteria's immune system. And the phage have their anti-CRISPRs. They're like duking it out on this micro, like scopic level. So what we need are different ways to tackle these bacteria, and phage and antibiotics are actually very good to be administered together because then the bacteria has a really hard time mutating.
Another question, is the U.S. working on a different phage to treat other septic shock patients that are resistant to many antibiotics?
Yes, in fact, there's phage therapy being done all around the world nowadays to treat other kinds of conditions as well. So other than the infections that are common amongst cystic fibrosis patients, prosthetic joint infections, so people that get a hip or a knee replacement or have an infected pacemaker line or have chronic urinary tract infections or those that have been victims of different attacks like the terrorist attack that I mentioned, or someone who goes in to have a simple surgery and gets a superbug infection while they're in the hospital. Those kinds of infections all happen, and those are the most common cases that we are hearing from, and we have worked on all of them so far. And in fact, Dr. Aslam has treated the majority of them.
And so IPATH is newly formed.
June of 2018, we formed.
If someone wants to participate in a clinical trial, do you have to be to live near a research center, or can people cross?
Well, the particular trial that I'm talking about, there are 20 different centers that are involved, and there will be treatment that's required. So you would need to be able to be near one of those. One of the resources that I neglected to mention in my talk is a website called clinicaltrials.gov. And it's a place, it's a publicly available search engine where you can enter different keywords like phage therapy, like cystic fibrosis, and you can find the trials that are going on and see if they're recruiting participants. So all of the details of the trial that I mentioned are actually there because any reputable research group that wants to publish their findings has to register their trial on that website. So that is the place where you can go and learn more. But we are going to be having a fact sheet available for those that are interested in more details.
So your husband, Tom, was the first person treated with intravenous use of phage.
In the U.S., yeah.
Say that again?
In the United States.
In the United States. Had other people received it, but in different forms? And if so, how was it administered?
Yes. Until my husband's case, intravenous phage therapy was not commonly administered, even in the former Soviet Union and in Poland, because of the fear of septic shock. And you have to purify the phage preparation because there are potential endotoxins that could cause septic shock. But other ways that phage should have been administered are through the nebulizer. So the photo that I showed of Ella, so she can talk about that experience. Some cystic fibrosis patients, though, have said that they don't want to breathe in through a nebulizer because it's irritating to their lungs. I say that as I recovered from COVID last month, and I'm like still, you know, having congestion, and I can imagine that it could irritate. So there's research being done on different kinds of nebulizers to try to minimize that kind of irritation. If someone has a skin infection, phage has actually been given topically. So Isabel had skin nodules due to her Mycobacterium abscessus, and she also had a lung infection. So she received it intravenously and topically on the skin. So those are just three different ways, and there are even more.
I'm trying to visualize the topically. What does it actually look like? I'm visualizing those little spider-like things.
Oh, yeah. Well,
I mean, put on.
It would just look like a cream or a gel. I mean, you can't see, right? The phage is like looking like that. That's just what, you know, if once you blow them up 100,000 times, that's what they look like. I mean, have you ever seen what fleas and bed bugs look like when you actually magnify those? They look like, you know, monsters from outer space.
Let's see, are there any hopes of collaborating with other countries who have been working on these treatments since their discovery 100 years ago?
Yes, I mean, we collaborate regularly with programs all around the world, and we have referred patients to some of the programs that have been operating since the very beginning. Where we differ at IPATH and most of the programs that I'm aware of in the US are, we're nonprofits. So the program in Poland and the one in Georgia are for profit. That's one of the important differences. And, you know, when you have an experimental treatment like phage therapy in the US, you can't charge for it. We sometimes have to ask patients to pay for the shipping or something like that. But so far, everything has been free. Oh, you're muted.
Oh, I was noting that as it popped up. We're going to hurry because we have just a few minutes for, and there are more questions, but I do want to let everybody know that Dr. Stathy will be on the panel next, so we can carry over the ones that aren't answered now. Is C. diff one of the bugs that might have phage therapy?
Yeah, so C. diff is a superbug, so it's a bacterium and there are phages that attack it. But when I mentioned that there's like these two different lifestyles of the phage rage kind, that's called the lytic phage life cycle, or the temperate phage life cycle, those are the sleepy ones. For whatever reason, C. diff and Borrelia, which causes Lyme disease, the phages that we can find for those organisms tend to be the sleepy kind. So that means that they need to be genetically modified or trained to become the phage rage kind. So there are researchers working on phage therapy for C. diff, but at this point, they're not ready yet. And so the first line of treatment for C. diff is a fecal transplant.
And our last question for this session, can phages be killed if the body doesn't respond well to them?
Well, if the body actually removes phages all the time. And so if phage are not finding any bacteria that they're matched to, the liver and the spleen just filter them out. And so and that's a natural process. It turns out that there's about 30 billion phages that move in and out of our body every single day. They're already there. They're the gatekeepers. The bacteria. We would have a lot of bacterial overgrowth if the phage weren't there. So there's nothing to be afraid of. It's just a matter of finding the right phage to kill. You're looking for the perfect predator to knock out the bacteria that is causing the problem.
Well, we cannot thank you enough for sharing your time and your expertise with us, but really most profoundly for the incredible work that you are doing that is helping certainly the CF community and so many more people. So thank you so much for this incredible session. And for everybody that's here, we're gonna close this room off, but you can go to the agenda at the top of your screen or go to the auditorium and click on the schedule. And we'll be back here in about a little over 10 minutes, and we can continue the conversation with Dr. Strathi.
See you soon, and you get to meet my husband, Tom, too.
That's right, this'll be a wonderful panel. So everybody come on back.
Thank you.
Thank you.